again, the fascinating Dr. Sam Parnia. Doctor, welcome back. Just before we get to the phones, we are going to go to the phones. I want to let people ask questions, but this one came in by email. I'm actually monitoring my emails as we go along. Is there any actual scientific evidence that consciousness is contained inside the brain in the same sense that, say, a liquid or gas can be contained inside of a physical container?
There isn't, no. I mean, the biggest mystery we currently face in science is actually understanding how our thoughts, our consciousness comes to arise from the brain, if at all from the brain. In simple terms, if you think about it, if you were to look at a brain cell, a neuron down a microscope, and I were to say to you, well, this cell is now thinking, you know, I'm hungry, or gosh, this guy talks so much, then you'd say, well, it's impossible because it's just a cell. I mean, cells can't think.
Right.
And so the problem we currently face in science is, well, how is it that if we were to connect two of these cells together, or hundreds or thousands or millions of them, essentially by electricity, where do thoughts come from? You know, how is it that if I were to throw a brick at my neighbor's window, why should my brain cells start to feel guilty about what I have done? Why should they have thoughts?
Yes.
They shouldn't do. So we have this is called the hard problem of consciousness, because we simply don't know how these things arise. We know they interact with the brain. We can demonstrate which areas of the brain become active when we have certain thoughts. That can be done very easily. But the big step of jumping from electrical activity in the brain to thoughts, which really, to some extent, almost feel like something completely different, we don't know.
Doctor, in the computer field, they're getting closer, and I guess closer, to someday being able to emulate the brain in storage, in speed, in all these different categories. So I wonder if it would be fair to say, if someday they create consciousness in a machine, that they have created life.
Well, I think we have to just touch on a point here, which is that when we talk about consciousness, we're not talking simply about calculations.
Right.
We're not talking, yes, we know that the brain, you can think of it as a very complex computer that can carry out thousands and millions of calculations at every moment in our lives, based upon information that it receives from all over our body, inside and outside the body.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not talking about that. We're talking about having thought processes. In other words, what we experience is our conscious self, and how that comes to be. And that's really different to a complex machine that may do very complex calculations.
Is it necessarily different, really? I mean, once you get to enough speed and enough storage, storage being memory, speed being, I guess, the way neurons communicate with chemical messengers to each other, if you get to that point with a machine, one has to wonder if they will, in fact, discover consciousness, or if it is completely unique, then the case that you're making is quite good.
Well, yes, of course. If brain cells can generate thoughts, and if it's simply a matter of fact that we haven't been able to discover them, then in theory, if at some point in the future, whether it's now 100 years or 500 years in the future, we can discover machinery that mimics the brain in some way through its complexity, then in theory we might be able to discover or generate some form of consciousness as well. If, however, consciousness is a separate scientific entity that hasn't yet been discovered and that isn't generated by those neurons, those brain cells,
right,
then, of course, we will simply manufacture a very complex
machine.
Computer.
Yeah, exactly. And that would, I guess, prove your point. So science someday may be able to actually establish that what we call consciousness, and by the way, do you define consciousness as more than awareness of self?
Yes, I describe it really as everything that we experience, the whole subjective world that we experience within ourselves. So our thoughts, feelings, emotions, everything that we have that makes us unique as individuals and gives us life and personality.
And these are probably the things that compel you to believe that these NDEs are real? The mystery of this?
It depends what you mean by real. I think like I explained earlier, we're at a very interesting point in science where we can actually test the validity of these claims, and these may indicate to us that actually, indirectly, they may indicate that mind or consciousness is a separate scientific entity that hasn't yet been discovered.
Yes. Yes. Is there any work going on, I mean, anything with electrical activity going on? It seems to me, if there is a consciousness, that it's operating at some level with some, something that we're ultimately going to be able to measure with an instrument. In other words, are you familiar, for example, with the experiments going on at Princeton University in consciousness?
Are you talking about the global consciousness
problem? I certainly am, yes.
I've heard about them. I don't know enough in detail to be able to comment in an informed way, absolutely. But I'm aware of it.
Well, you're going to absolutely love it, and in view of what you've done, I would think that you should jump right into that, because it sort of parallels what you just said about it being separate but yet still perhaps measurable. They've done good scientific work at Princeton, and they may be measuring collective consciousness. It's really fascinating. Let's go to the phones. First-time caller line. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Parnia.
Hello?
Hello.
I didn't know if that was me or not.
It's you.
All right, Art. I've sure had a hard time trying to get to talk to you, but I have a lot of answers. I just don't know if it's the time to release them. And if there's some way, I can't get online, I'm...
All right, well, do you have a question for my guest?
Well, yes. What is the... Are you familiar with the fact that there's been some scientific writings from the early 1700s that speak of a spiritual body, a natural body, and that the spiritual body is what goes on, the natural body, of course, stays here. And there's a spiritual mind, a natural mind, and it's rather.
All right. Well, a lot of people, like this man, do believe, Doctor, that there's the mind or the brain, and then there is a separate spiritual or consciousness that you just spoke about. Is that your belief?
Well, you see, historically, there has been the concept that there is a soul. And if you look back to, whether philosophical literature or religious literature, essentially it's a concept that it's something that gives us life and that remains after we die. No one could probably describe in detail exactly what the nature of this is, but it's a concept that we have that goes back generations and many, many years. And in science today, what we're trying to understand is, what is consciousness? Again, so what is it that gives us life? That gives us our thoughts and our personality and who we are. And it may be that we're all describing the same concept, it's just that we're calling it different things.
Yes.
But what is interesting is that science now, for the first time, and this has only been happening in the last 20 or so years, has become interested in trying to understand this, which had been previously considered purely a subject of debate for philosophy or theology. And obviously, everything that exists within... the objective or the testable domain, and it's simply really our limitation, our scientific limitations, that sometimes don't allow us to discover what those concepts are. And then I'm sure one day we'll be able to find out what consciousness is and how our thoughts are.
Boy.
And what happens when we die.
Doctor, if science were to ever prove not... that NDEs are real, not that there is any life after death at all, but if science were to ever conclude conclusively that, in fact, there is nothing after death, this is probably a question you don't get very often, can you imagine the incredible impact it would have on the world?
I think it would have a huge impact.
Oh, boy.
But obviously, we'd have to. The big if is obviously it has to have been tests that have been done appropriately to be able to answer the question. And it shouldn't be the fact that we are limited in not having appropriate apparatus or instruments to measure what happens at that time.
Well, I sure wouldn't want to be the guy who had to walk out and announce that to the world as a conclusive piece of evidence.
Mm.
Holy mackerel. I once interviewed a fellow named, actually several times, Matthew Alper, and he has written a book. He's not a believer in any higher power at all. He's written a book called The God Part of the Brain.
Yes.
Oh, you're familiar with that?
I'm familiar with the concept, but sure, go ahead.
Well, it's just that if you go to the deepest part of the jungles and, you know, the most out-of-the-way places, and you come in contact with people who have never come in contact with the modern world, they inevitably, absolutely worship something.
Yes.
And so that alone is worth study. It means something that the human being, no matter where and under whatever circumstances, grows to worship something, be it the sun, the moon, God, Buddha, whatever. He worships something. And so there's got to be some part of our brain that almost demands we do that.
Well, I'm sure you're also familiar with other research that's been carried out by Dr. Andrew Newberg. And he studied areas of the brain that are involved in spiritual or religious experiences.
Uh-huh.
So he's been studying people who meditate and studying which parts of the brain become active during that time. And certainly we've been able to identify through this type of work that there are specific areas of the brain that are involved with religious experiences, that, you know, it's not that people have religious experiences and it's separate from the brain. It takes place, again, through the brain. And so it may well be that there are areas of the brain that are geared towards our, should we say, spiritual life.
Yes.
But again, like any other thing, if we identify those areas of the brain, it doesn't tell us whether an experience is real
right.
or not.
That's simply right.
A chemical that goes across the brain. It's a bit like if you were to imagine you had a satellite and you were able to watch, I don't know if you've seen, but you know, in Egypt in the olden days, because the River Nile is such an important source of water for that country,
mm-hmm.
in the olden days, what they used to do was to just develop little waterways that would come out and branch out of the of the river. And what we now do is we study brain activity, and we can study where blood flow goes and how it changes. And so if you imagine if you had a satellite and you were looking down at the Nile and you could see little tributaries coming out of the Nile, you could conclude from that there is activity going on down there. But you couldn't conclude anything beyond that, and that's what we're doing with the brain. What we see is we see activity within the brain cells, but it doesn't tell us if an experience is real or not. It just tells us that there is blood flow going on to the particular area.
All right. Wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Parnia. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Vicki from Denver.
Yes, Vicki.
And thank you so much for taking my call. I have two really quick questions. One, I've always read about energy. I've always thought of consciousness as energy. We have emotional, kinetic energy. And there's a theory that energy does not die, nor is created, but is merely transformed.
Well, I think that's more than a theory.
Yeah, exactly. So I wondered what the doctor had to say about that. And my second note is that I had an NDE back in 79. And just a question about that. My experience was I was pulled through a tunnel to the light and given the option of whether to go back, and I hesitated. I mean, I didn't hesitate. I said, I have to go back. In all the readings I've done, I've never heard of anybody that did not hesitate like I did not hesitate, and I wondered if he had come across anyone like that.
Well, I bet we never hear from the people who say, I don't want to go back. All right, listen, thank you very much for the call. Both very good questions. The first question, Doctor, about energy.
Well, obviously, as you pointed out, that is something that is well accepted, that energy just changes, but it doesn't die out. The problem we have, though, in relation to consciousness is that we simply don't know what the nature of consciousness is yet, and we're limited by our scientific tools. We don't have the right apparatus. In the same way that, you know, 50 years ago, if you said to somebody, we can have a scanner that can look inside the brain up to 1 or 2 millimeters accuracy, in other words, an MRI scanner, They would have laughed at us.
Oh, yes.
We simply don't have a tool or a machine that can show us thoughts and consciousness yet. It doesn't mean that we won't have it, but we don't have it yet. So how that relates to consciousness in terms of energy, of course, we simply don't know because we don't know what consciousness is yet.
Well, no, but it makes the fact that energy does not die, I guess, you know, gives people hope. And it's true, energy does not die.
That's right.
I suppose the most you could say is, well, it might disperse randomly and just sort of become something else, but it doesn't die. So, I don't know. This is all really something to even contemplate, even to think about, and certainly very difficult to get funding for. Where would you first think you would look for funding? Not to the government, I presume, but to some wealthy individual who wants answers?
I think, either a philanthropist who is interested in supporting scientific research or medical charities that deal with understanding what happens during cardiac arrest, because essentially we are studying the human mind and consciousness during that time. And as I pointed out, there are reports that consciousness may continue during that time. Another way of obviously getting funding may be potentially to try to, devise new therapies for people who have depressive illnesses based upon identifying which areas of the brain become active after a near-death experience.
That one seems very likely from a clinical point of view. I mean, depression is a monstrous problem all around the world.
Absolutely.
So if this, and you feel this really might give some answers about how better to deal with depression to perhaps stimulate certain very specific parts of the brain, is that the idea?
Yes, because this was actually an idea that was given to me by a doctor at Baylor Medical Center in Houston, Dr. Lily Fong. And she told me, and it's made so much sense, is that obviously if we can identify the changes that happened in the genes of people after they've had a near-death experience, in other words, the areas that mediate the positive effects of a near-death experience on the individual, then we could try to artificially stimulate those areas and hence bring about the same good feelings or positive feelings that those individuals have had, but without having to go through a critical illness.
Hmm. That, if you could actually do that, I guess it would lead people perhaps even away from the idea that NDEs are real in an external sense. It might be a good thing to do for medicine, certainly, but the very fact that it could be done would probably weigh down on the other side of the argument, right?
What it shouldn't do, what it would probably do, which I think is a good thing, is make it very clear to people that simply by identifying areas of the brain that mediate any experience, that does not validate in any way the experience itself. In the same way that we could theoretically devise treatments that could stimulate feelings of love in people, it doesn't mean that love itself is a hallucination.
So it seems to me that if people can describe what's going on while they're dead, that's proof of NDEs. Now, what it may not be proof of is an afterlife. Is that correct, Doctor?
Well, it would certainly demonstrate to us that consciousness can separate from the brain and can continue to function when we reach the end of life. It won't tell us what happens hours later. Obviously, we don't have the means, but certainly would give us an indication of what happens in the first few seconds, maybe up to an hour of the dying process.
Hmm. So are you personally convinced, you know, this is a personal question you don't have to answer, Doctor, but are you personally convinced that, that NDEs are real?
I think that NDEs are real in the sense that they take place, absolutely.
All right.
If you mean, do they mean an afterlife, I don't yet know.
Do you have hope that in your lifetime you will know?
I certainly hope that we'll be able to do the right test, yes, that we'll be able to find out what happens when people die through scientific means, and to answer this age-old philosophical and religious question. through the objectivity of science.
Doctor, how's your book doing? Is it? It's just out, isn't it?
It's only just come out in the U.S. in the last. I think it's only been out for about 2 weeks now.
Uh huh.
So I don't yet know myself, actually.
Well, I think it's going to do real well. I mean, based on the way you've answered questions this morning, if your book is like that, it's going to do very well. So there is a question for you. Does your book deal with mainly what we've been talking about this morning?
Yes, it does. It's really both a story of how I got involved in this research, and it's also summarizes really what's been happening in near-death experience research and the work that has been carried out since by ourselves and others, and where the future lies in this kind of research.
Well, we have Dr. Moody, and now we have you, Doctor. Do you see other people of science entering this arena?
I think there are a number of other people who have done very good work. Probably the person who I have the most respect for is Professor Bruce Grayson, who works here in the United States, and he's published a number of studies on near-death experiences. But relatively, unfortunately, there are very few people out there who are doing this kind of work. I think there are only two groups currently working. One is Professor Bruce Grayson's group here, and one is our group where the research had been carried out in the United Kingdom. And there's nobody else who's doing any work right now in the world on this, as far as I know.
That's absolutely pathetic.
It's very disappointing, I have to say.
Pathetic. To be the biggest question for man and to have only that going on is just pathetic. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Parnia. Hello.
Yes, hello, Art and Dr. Parnia.
Hi.
I'd like to submit something that may answer both of those questions, survival of consciousness and also an afterlife, not the kind of consciousness like we're just abstractly floating in an auric egg in space, where you know that I and I am me.
Yes.
I'll pray say it way down. 10 years ago, my sister passed on. She was very ill. 7.5 weeks after that, I was wide awake, so I decided to read. You know, you can't just stare at walls. I was reading nothing more strange than one of Emerson's essays, wide awake, almost as though some doctor had just injected me with sodium pentothal or whatever. I couldn't keep my eyes open. A sudden swish, like someone turned a switch. 2 seconds later, I was floating above my body. And the next thing I knew, I'm getting chills even remembering it, holding my hand. And it was tangible, which means whatever body we were manifesting in, it was my sister. And I said, Jerry, it's you. She said, well, of course it is, real matter-of-factly. And the first thing, this shows I had consciousness. I said, am I dead? After all, if Jerry is dead and I'm there with her,
of course.
You know, come on, like you, how foolish. No one is dead. No one dies. And we were actually flying to a place, don't ask me where, it was like an alabaster illuminated gazebo. And she said, please tell everyone in the family that I knew you wouldn't be afraid, which she's correct. Tell them everything is hunky-dory. That was her favorite expression.
Hunky-dory.
After we talked for a bit, we went back. And then I felt her hand slip away, and the next thing I knew, my body jerked, so suddenly.
Back into your body.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Doctor, this is actually a very, very, very good question. All the reports, like you just heard from that lady, and of ghosts, and of spirits, and of EVPs, and of all of these, you know, fringy kind of things, in a way, they potentially could sort of wind into your research, couldn't they?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm very much researching specifically what happens to people at the point of death.
Yes.
So it's a very specific clinical scenario, although once you expand out into the implications this would have for understanding the nature of human consciousness, and then, of course, you know, all experiences would fit into it, because we simply don't know how they arise and how they relate to the brain.
No, we sure don't. And if the answer ultimately to the question is that consciousness does survive, then the kind of thing that lady just described, it could happen. It could be part of the yes answer. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Parnia. Good morning.
Hi, my name is Peter.
Yes.
I'm from Marrero, Louisiana.
Yes, sir.
I have two questions. I guess I'll ask the first one first. How do I get involved or maybe volunteer for any kind of study to towards what you do? And secondly, actually, the most important one, in anything that you've seen, any of your NDEs, have they seen or spoken to any of their dead family or friends?
So in other words, sir, you're volunteering to be flatlined. Is that correct?
No, I think you're doing that.
I'm kidding with him. all right. Well, I don't know if there's any way you can become involved. Doctor, is there?
It probably is very difficult. It depends on what the gentleman can do. We're obviously looking at people in hospital settings whose heart stops for whatever different reasons. So at this point, that's really... We would look for collaboration with people who are working in hospitals. But I think to answer your second question...
Yes.
That's a very interesting question that you're asking. A lot of people describe seeing deceased relatives. It's almost as if when they're going through a dying process, as if those relatives are there to comfort them through that experience, almost to welcome them there. And they will often see, perhaps, say, a mother or a father that they were very close to. They may have a conversation with that person.
Yes.
Usually, if they have a discussion or a conversation, it's carried out in almost like a telepathic manner. So it's all through a conversation with thoughts. People don't actually verbalize. It's a bit like when we have dreams. We may have a conversation, but actually, if you think about it, you don't normally see your lips moving. It's just through your thoughts that you converse.
Yes.
And it's carried out in a similar manner.
How frequently are these, you know, unexpected relatives? I guess that's a way to put it. To meet people that you would not necessarily have the expectation of meeting or be surprised to be meeting. Does that question make sense?
Yes, I think, well, I couldn't give you an actual percentage, but the majority of times it's usually people who are closer, although I have had people who have told me that they saw, say, a deceased aunt or maybe a friend or somebody who isn't necessarily as close as we would expect, say, a mother or father or a brother or sister.
And you get up there and say, my God, it's Aunt Doris.
Yeah, the people say that. You know, I saw my aunt who died, 30 years ago, and she was there, and, they've described that, absolutely.
That also is very interesting, because it would mean you were having an experience that there was no immediate frame of reference for. You might expect to meet mom or dad, but not sort of a further away relative. So that's fascinating. A wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Parnia. Hello.
Hello, Art and Dr. Parnia.
Hello.
A quick comment and one good question, please.
Sure.
Art, I had a T-shirt made up for the Starwood Festival that says, "Is our memory an experience? ? Are our thoughts an experience? ? And is experience an experience? ? Dr. Parnia, since we interpret our sensations through the electrical chemical processes in our brain, what makes the car going by any more real than, say, our dreams or doing DMT, for example?
Ah.
Well, that's a very good question.
Yeah, it is.
Because, as you know, I'm sure, when we see something and we experience it as being real, it's essentially that, we have certain activity within the back of the brain, and that will give us, we interpret that as meaning something to us, say, for example, a car going along.
Mm-hmm.
But if we think about a car going along and we close our eyes and we think about it, the same areas of the brain become active. And this really touches on the point that I made earlier, that just because a part of the brain becomes active doesn't tell us about the reality of the event. And in fact, it's probably difficult to go through it on the program tonight, but reality is really socially determined. So a group of people will decide on what meaning they can give to an observation. And that is really dictated by our society that we live in and the time that we live in, so that with time you see that certain things that we take for granted as being real are then changed. And it very much depends on the people in society who are dictating it, or who are, if they're perceived as being more, shall we say, important or significant members of society, that they will tell us what meaning to give to what we see.
So if two people see a UFO, it's real?
It's real for them. That's all we can say. That's the point. You know, if for example, I say that I saw my mother even, that's real for me. It's difficult for anybody else to say whether it was really real or not. I just want to also point out that we're also limited in terms of understanding the reality of the world around us. We're very much limited by the apparatus that we have, in other words, the brain. Our brain is tuned to being able to take data and information in a 3D way. We know that there are more than three dimensions out in the universe. Science has shown that. But our brain, our computer, however you want to think of it, is limited in the way that it can take information, and so are all our senses. Our eyes can only see within a certain limited amount. Our ears are the same limited. So what we do to compensate for that is we devise instruments. We build microscopes. We build telescopes to be able to see beyond what we can normally see with the naked eye.
Right.
And so what we have to understand is that as human beings, we're very limited in understanding what is real out there. And if we confine everything that is real to what we can understand within our three-dimensional brain, we're very likely to have missed out on a big chunk of reality simply because we don't have an apparatus or a machine to be able to pick it up.
Wow. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Pernia. Good morning.
Good morning, Art and Dr. Pernia. In response to the initial fast blast that indicated some questions about where consciousness is coming from, I wanted to cite the work of John Lorber from Sheffield University that did research on hydrocephalics and found that certain had very high IQs, but virtually no brain, just about a millimeter or so of neural tissue lining the inside of the skull. So this flies in the face of the late, great Walter Penfield and his Center in Cephalic Coordination of Consciousness, or John C. Eccles and the parietal lobe, and etc. And it really disturbs a number out there that research brain activity when you find that there's virtually no gray matter or lobes or fissures to speak of, and you're talking about people having higher than normal IQs. And lastly, I wanted to respond to the diagnostic procedures for measuring this kind of very delicate activity. Well, far beyond MRIs and nuclear magnetic resonance is superconducting quantum interference technology, or SQIDs. These measure bioelectromagnetic phenomena down to the ionic structure, and coupled with the work of people like William A. Tiller, one of my favorite guests on your show, Art, his work on the power within the vacuum of an atom,
yes,
and the redundancy built throughout the universe makes superluminal communication possible, action at a distance, and it ties in well with the work of Jack Sarfatti and Henry Snapp and Carl Pribram that's looked at the holographic universe. So I thought these might be some interesting directions to pursue. Carl Pribram, Jack Sarfatti.
Yes.
William A. Tiller would be a good person to have on at some point to discuss the non-locality of the universe and how things can, in fact, be transmitted in a very physical way.
All right. Excellent. All excellent suggestions. And obviously, Doctor, your work could take many, many different directions, but with so few people doing the research, I just, you know, I can see how you've got to stay right on course for now, anyway. Someday, maybe the world will wake up. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Pernia. Hello. Hello.
Hi, this is Susan.
Okay, Susan, you're going to have to yell at us. You're not too loud.
Hi, this is Susan. I'm from Los Angeles. In 2000, I had two NDEs, from one from open heart surgery and one from cardiac arrest 5 months later. I've also been a person who's studied consciousness most of my life, and I would like to ask the doctor the question between measuring consciousness through, you know, activity in the brain and perhaps measuring consciousness through the seat of the soul electromagnetically, like Dr. Moss measured with Carillion photography. And if perhaps there he could comment on whether the possibility exists that the brain is nothing more than a gathering place of information that definitely experiences...
You're laying an awful lot on the table. Let's stick with the Carillion photography for a moment. Is it possible, Doctor, that some other method of measurement may find activity and energy that conventional methods so far have been unable to detect, as in Krillian photography?
I'm sure that in theory, of course, yes, the answer to that question is yes, that there will be methods that can be devised that can that perhaps we don't know yet, or that are not conventional at this point, that can measure activity. I don't know enough about Krillian photography to be able to make a judgment about the accuracy of the work. I know that it's been done, but I don't really know if it's reproducible from a scientific point of view.
Well, I think that it may be, and it's probably worth investigation, but again, I understand your narrow field. Caller, I'm sorry, anything else?
Yeah, I would just sort of like to comment on my own experience, and that's that I do believe that consciousness exists in a place other, in addition to existing in the mind and being measurable in the mind,
mm-hmm.
that it's also felt in the seat of the soul. And that's the part that we talk about that continues on. My own personal experience is that, you know, I saw lots of things that, you know, family members that I knew were related to me but had no idea who they were in tunnels, saw and, you know, had communication with my grandmother and something, you know, much greater than me behind her at the same time. That forever changed my life. And when I listen to, you know, trying to approach it from a scientific point of view, and while I understand your guest is a clinician, what I'd like to tell you from my own personal experience is that I don't know that I could ever have understood it with my mind, but I certainly understand it with my soul.
I've got you. I've got you. And on that note, Doctor, we're out of time, but boy, what a guest you have been. What Happens When We Die is the name of the book. You should go find it on Amazon or wherever you can find it. What Happens When We Die by Dr. Sam Parnia. Doctor, I want to thank you for being here. Just a terrific guest.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure, Art. It's been wonderful to be on the program.
And I would like to do it again sometime, all right?
It'll be my pleasure.